Good morning. Welcome to After the Brief, a Field Guide to Design Inspiration. Hello? Maybe? There we go. My name is Jason Santa Maria. I'm the creative director at Happy Cog Studios. Thank you. With offices in both Philadelphia and New York.
Hi, I'm Rob Weichert. I am the art director at Happy Cog Studios.
It's going to be a long presentation.
Yeah, one of two ginger art directors at Happy Cog Studios.
And you might be saying, who are these two jerks and where's the good-looking one? Cameron Maul actually came down with the flu, and he will not be here today. But we do have a replacement. Flat John Hicks is going to accompany us on stage.
He also couldn't be here today, but his cardboard version could. He's only going to be able to join us for a short while. He's going to be ducking out to see some other panels as well. And Cameron wanted you to know that he sends his regrets. He would absolutely be here under any circumstances other than the fact that he is on death's doorstep. So keep him in your thoughts. He's not feeling well.
So today what we want to focus on mostly is inspiration. And the three larger points here are, what is inspiration? Where you can find it, and how do you foster a creative environment and maintain that inspiration?
So, if we're going to talk about defining inspiration, we want to talk about what we're talking about when we say inspiration, because people have different ideas about what it is. And I think one of the easiest ways to begin talking about inspiration is really talking about what it's not. I find that a lot of people use the words inspiration and influence interchangeably, and I think that's a mistake. Because really, influence is this thing where you're looking at other people that are doing the same thing that you're doing or a similar thing, and trying to kind of find ideas in what they've done and maybe appropriate them for yourself. So if you're designing a car, you look at other cars and say, oh, that's cool. Me too. I will do that. Or you know, other websites, as a lot of us will do, say, oh, that's a neat idea. I'll try something like that too. And it becomes this kind of me too thing where it's like photocopying a photocopy. And it just gets watered down and ultimately builds cliches. And so your idea, which seemed so cool a week ago, gets really old really fast. Inspiration, I think, is something quite different, and it's really something that has more potential for shelf life. So if influence is comparing apples to apples, inspiration really is more about comparing apples to oranges, or Buicks, or David Hasselhoff, or this guy down here. And inspiration really is about recognizing the value and the opportunities that exist in everything that surrounds you, and all of the ideas that surround you and the ways that they relate to each other. So it's really kind of the sum of your experiences, and I'll explain what I'm talking about with that. There's a famous parable about Pablo Picasso, where in the story he's sitting in the park, and he's approached by a woman who says, oh my God, you are Pablo Picasso, the legend. I adore you. You absolutely must do a portrait of me. And Picasso says, all right. And he takes a piece of paper, scribbles a single simple line on the paper, and hands it to the woman. And she is beside herself. She's, oh my, this is incredible. You have captured my essence in the most profound way. I am just awestruck. What do I owe you for this breathtaking work of art? And Picasso says, $50,000. And the woman says, $50,000? That took you 5 seconds to create. And he says, my dear woman, it took me my entire life. And the point here is that inspiration is the sum total of your experiences reacting to new stimuli, and that's what allows your imagination to be excited. It's about, you know, seeing these things around you and relating them to what you already know and understand and finding new ways of relating these things to each other.
So now that we know what inspiration is, where do we find it? Is it something that you interact with on a daily basis? Is it something that you see when you walk down the street? Is it all of these things? Rob and I gain a lot of inspiration from different sources in our lives. But one that has always sort of stuck with us from back when we were in college is history. Graphic design, like any art form, has a very rich and dynamic and diverse history. And if you're going to try and do design that is informed and is trying to push boundaries towards the future, you have to see where you've been before. Luckily, a gentleman named Philip Meggs has created this compendium called A History of Graphic Design. Philip Meggs was basically the preeminent authority on the history of graphic design. And in this book, what he seeks to do is set graphic design, include graphic design as in history and set it into context among the rest of the history of the world so that you can see how design has impacted things and become impacted by social movements, cultural involvement, wars, different cultures. And the thing about this is that once you see where design is and where it's been, you can start to see where design is headed and where influences come from and where inspiration comes from the past. Starting with early forms of visual communication like cave paintings, some of the most iconic of visual languages, up to movements of, you know, design, different design movements, and also through to the computer to design today. And once you see how design impacts all of this, you get a better sense of where your design falls in the timeline of history.
So Stan and I are both big history nerds, design history specifically, and I've had good fortune to really make good use of that in some of the projects I've worked on. So Born Magazine was one of those. You may be familiar with Born Magazine, some of you might not. In its own words, Born is an experimental venue marrying literary arts with interactive media. And basically what they do is foster collaborations between writers and designers who work together to come up with an interactive literary piece of some sort. So I was asked to participate in last summer's issue of Born, and I was paired up with a poet named Kiki Petrosino, who submitted a piece entitled I Didn't Know Infants in Arms Until. This poem is written from the perspective of an American who has spent some time in Italy, presumably studying, and when she returns to the States, she's really disillusioned, and she now sees her own national culture as really banal and garish and vulgar when compared to the really earned character of Italy and the stories and the tradition and the culture and the history that it has, which is so much deeper than our own. The imagery in the poem is so vividly described that I didn't think I'd be doing the work any justice by using photography or illustration. So I thought I would supplement the words with sound and let the typography do the rest of the work. That's a lot of work for one typeface to do, so it really needed to be just the right typeface. As it happens, much of what she's talking about Italy is Venice, and Venice just happens to have been the 15th century home of Venetian Old Style, which is one of the most singularly important typographic movements in history. Basically, these were the original Roman letter forms. These were some of the first types to be designed that did not go out of their way to emulate handwriting, but really sought to set typography as this sort of sovereign entity from handwriting and this new move towards, you know, I guess automated, you know, communication production. Tremendously influential, and most of the type we still use today owes an awful lot to the Venetian Old Style. So, since in the poem, the narrator is pining for this Italian heritage that she never really belonged to, I thought a parallel typographic statement could be made by using a modern revival of a Venetian Old Style type. And that's just what Robert Slimbach did in 1996 with Adobe Jensen. Now, this is an homage to Nicholas Jensen, who's one of the pioneers of Venetian Old Style. And Slimbach's done a really amazing job here of emulating Jensen's letter forms, cleaning them up, bringing them into the digital age. And really, for the purposes of this project, I thought he did too good of a job. So I kept looking, and I found Vendetta, which was designed for Emigre by John Downer in 1999. And what really struck me about Vendetta, if you look at it next to Adobe Jensen, they're both clearly based on the same model. But Adobe Jensen really religiously follows the original letter forms, whereas Vendetta puts more of a 20th century stamp on them. So you can see the top of the serif is concave instead of convex. The whole thing is more geometric and angular, And it's really more modern than humanist. It's a postmodern typeface. It was clearly designed in the 1990s as opposed to the 1470s. And for that matter, it was clearly designed by somebody who never experienced Nicholas Jensen's world firsthand, much like our narrator never really experienced this historic Italy that she holds so dear. The final irony in the piece was setting it on black, with white text on black, which, of course, is the exact opposite of what would have been happening back in the 15th century, which was almost exclusively black ink on white vellum. And the darkness really kind of suited the tone of the piece as well.
It's going to be a quiz on Venetian old style later. Rob and I both went to school together, and when we started studying graphic design, we were focusing more on print design and various print medias. And part of our curriculum was to take some older art forms, like printmaking, silk screening, things like this. And a lot of these experiences that we've had started to inform the way that we designed once we got onto the computer, and later once we got into agencies and, you know, started to learn more about interactive media and got into web work. Because of this, we're still very much interested in these analog forms of communication, these analog forms of art that... Recently, last year, we got a chance to take a letterpress class at Philadelphia at a university in Philadelphia called University of the Arts. And what's interesting about this is Rob and I both walked in the door with sort of preconceived notions of what we thought letterpress was about and what we thought about classic typography. And what we weren't really prepared for was what was going to sort of happen once we started doing it. The sort of emotions and feelings that you get when you pull out a drawer of letter forms, like something that... like a craftsman and an artist has actually created for the purpose of making art, for the purpose of making more creative things. Seeing the way that these shapes have taken form is just amazingly inspiring. Mixing your own inks by hand, finding those hues and those colors to make your design sing, getting a paper run through the press bed, experimenting with different color inks, experimenting with different layouts, sort of embracing the imprecise science of something that you possibly, you know, can't possibly really learn in just one class. Locking type into a press bed, seeing that these objects, you know, have physical space and they maintain that space in the world, and they take up space in a press bed, so that when you're locking something in, you have to understand, you know, how these letter forms interact, and because of that, there are constraints. And these are things that we really take for granted on the computer. Things like, you know, you have dozens and dozens of typefaces, but how often do you really look at the letter forms? Do you ever understand what went into that face? Does it have any sort of cultural emphasis or cultural meaning, larger meanings beyond just something that you're going to read? This was put in a stark contrast for Rob and I when we decided we were going to do this project and not worry about using some of those big letter forms, which are sometimes easier to deal with, but we were going to set a lot of copy. We wanted to really punish ourselves and figure out, you know, how to set a bunch of this lead type. So we decided to set this 40-line Edgar Allan Poe poem called The Conqueror Worm.
God forbid anything ever be easy.
And the thing that we discovered, as you know, we only have 3 hours per class, and there's no studio time outside of the class. So everything that we do has to be done within that amount of time. After two classes, we finish all of this type, and we're so excited. We're going to throw it down on the press bed, get some ink on there, you know, and see what it actually looks like on paper. When we get it on the press bed, we realize we were using two slightly different composing sticks to measure these lines out, and they're a fraction of an inch different in length, each one of them. So, you know, from one line to the next, they're just a little bit off, which means that because these are physical objects, we can't lock it into the press, and we can't print. We have to spend another class going back and balancing each one of these lines, pulling out small pieces of lead, and reformatting this entire block of copy. This is something that you don't dream of now because you're on a computer. This would take less than 5 minutes from, you know, typing this out on the computer, out to the printer, you're done. But because of the analog nature of this, you have to deal with these physical objects in space. The piece eventually came out fine, but this was a lesson that was sort of hard learned. This took the better part of 10 or 11 hours for us to produce this small bit of text. So because we're sort of gluttons for punishment and we like these hands-on mediums, I decided that when I want to get away from the computer, I like to sort of experiment with different things, try out different ideas. And last year, I made these business cards for South by Southwest. And the only thing I wanted to do was make sure that I wasn't going to type anything up. Yes, Flat Hicks has to go to another panel. He's a busy man. So the only goal here is just to not do anything on the computer. So what I decided, I'm going to get these big sheets of paper. I'm going to silkscreen large fields of orange and yellow ink, and then get one of those boring old self-inking office stamps with all my information on it. I'll stamp each one of these. I bought a cheap corner rounder at a craft store, and I clipped off all the corners. And this is something that I wouldn't have done if I were going to make business cards on my computer. I wouldn't have come across this idea because I probably would have been focusing on, you know, just a single wash of color or something less interesting. But each one of these cards is unique, and that's really exciting to me. In that same letterpress class, for this year, I decided to do new business cards. And what's cool about this, because I'm dealing with a different medium and I'm dealing with the constraints or opportunities that are inherent in that medium, I have an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. So if I was on a computer and I was designing my business cards, I probably would be dealing with one single canvas front and one single canvas on the back. But here, I'm dealing with 8 canvases. So what can I do that's interesting to sort of set this apart? I can put my name real huge on it, so when they are cropped in to different cards, I get an interesting typographic abstract shape. And then I have 8 different cards, so why not have 8 separate sayings on these cards? So they follow form, Jason Santa Maria, and then there's something under it, like Jason Santa Maria sleeps with his eyes open, Jason Santa Maria once sneezed 28 times in a row, Jason Santa Maria picks his teeth with his business cards. And these are fun things, and I would have never come across this idea. I would have never thought of it if I was on the computer, because I would have been dealing with a different space to have that idea. Because we're designers, and because designers have to communicate, and our work has to communicate, there's an inherent element of storytelling involved in it. And something that's always inspired me are books, specifically sort of run-of-the-mill paperback sci-fi horror books, because there's this sort of multi-layering of storytelling going on here. You have the book itself, the story that's being told in the book. You have the artist who's illustrated the book, who's trying to represent whatever the story is about. But then you also have the book itself, which is a physical object in this world. So it has its own experiences as time goes on. You know, maybe pages are bent, someone has written in it, someone spilled coffee on it. This book has its own story now, and as it travels through time, that story gets more and more rich. I find that terribly interesting. And a few years ago when I designed my site, I wanted to sort of bring that same feeling into the design of my site, this sort of used world, something that's been lived in, something that's been experienced. And there's a real emotional attachment with that, especially when it comes to books. I don't really know many people who throw out books. A lot of people hand down books, or they, you know, give them to someone else, because there's something very emotionally involved in there. You remember places and times where you were when you read a book. And because I'm into sci-fi and horror, I like to dress up my site every Halloween and every October to celebrate this. So a few years ago, the site takes on a more macabre look where someone must have gotten hurt while reading it. And last year,
I was
inspired by Edgar Allan Poe. So, you know, the paperback idea is ditched. Now it's this cloth-bound gothic tome with gold leafing and, you know, ornate drop caps. And this is something that I think is very interesting, bringing the tactile world into a two-dimensional digital world. One other point I want to make here is when I was younger, I used to read a lot of comic books. I originally set out to be an illustrator. And once I got to school and I met people like Kevin Cornell, I realized I was nowhere near good enough to be an illustrator. So I decided to take up graphic design. And something that appeals to me now would have never appealed to me as a kid. Because when I was a kid, I was into comic books, you know, with muscle-bound superheroes flying over the sky, beating up robots and crap like that. But now I can really get into a comic book like this. This is a graphic novel by Chris Ware. Chris Ware it takes a much more minimalistic graphic approach to his art. And when I was a kid, I would have thought this was crap because, you know, no one has muscles. No one has lasers coming out of their eyes. But there's still so much rich design here. All this typography is done by hand. All this layout is done by hand in a thoroughly laborious process. And the take that he does when he writes these is he actually writes it with pictures and then comes back to the dialogue. He tries to imbue as much emotion into each panel as he can. And that's a very inspiring thing because this is a different way to write. This is a different way to illustrate. And he's very much, I think, you know, based on all the typography and the really laborious handwork that he does, it reminds me more of like a 40s or 50s advertising sign painter, someone who has that sort of crazy skill with a pencil and all these geometric shapes.
So, okay, we spent some time talking about what we think inspiration is and some of the various places we reliably find it. But it's kind of like grocery shopping when you're finding inspiration. You know, you go to the store, you get your groceries, you bring them home. If you don't put them in the refrigerator, they're not going to keep. And in the same way, you have to maintain inspiration after you found it. You can't just, you know, there's not an inspiration on-off switch where you go, oh, I'm inspired. That's fantastic. Oh, okay, I'll turn it off now and watch TV. It's something that you really have to, make your mind a fertile ground for inspiration to take root when it's ready, because you can't predict it, but you can be ready for it. A British design luminary named Alan Fletcher once said, design is not a thing you do, it's a way of life. And he was a big proponent for this idea that I think is very important, that, you know, you're a designer when you're at work, and then you clock out and you go home, and you should still be a designer. It's a lifestyle. It's not just a job. And it needs to really impact everything that you do and everything that you see and the way that you approach everything that you do and see. And it needs to have real meaning in your life beyond just a paycheck. Alan Fletcher passed away back in October, unfortunately. But before he did, he left us an amazing book called The Art of Looking Sideways. And it took him, I think, more than 10 years of his life to put this book together. And if you see it in person, and I highly, highly recommend you get yourself a copy, you can see it's evident that this thing would have taken an incredibly long time to put together. The book is basically a celebration of ideas and imagery and the relationships between everything that surrounds us and the opportunities, like we were saying before, the opportunities that exist in everything that surrounds us and finding relationships and finding ideas that can be extracted from things that may never have intended to have those ideas extracted from them. Just the idea that, you know, the everything that surrounds you is sort of a living organism unto itself and is filled with all these components that interact with each other and impact each other. And to really have an awareness of that is to be prepared for inspiration.
Like Rob said, when you're encountering all this stuff around you, I mean, when you walk through your day-to-day life, you are bombarded, absolutely bombarded by design of all shapes and sizes. And there's so much inspiration that can be gained and gleaned from that. But, I mean, we're imperfect people, and we forget things quite often. So how do you keep track of this stuff? If you rely on just your mind, you're going to miss out on a lot of opportunities to be inspired. One thing that I try to do is keep an archive of visuals. iPhoto is a program on the Mac that's used to basically organize all of your personal photos, but I find it's also useful to keep a visual archive of things that inspire you. And these aren't things that you're keeping and collecting to sort of copy from, but things that spark some sort of idea in you, and you want to be able to bring that back. And if you're just relying on your mind, you're going to forget. So you might have found, you know, some inspiring Mexican matchbooks that have typography like you've never seen before, or color palettes like you could have never imagined using. So you keep those so that when you need that spark, when you need to ignite that idea again, you can go back and you can look at it, and it'll bring you back to that place, and it'll connect that emotion for you again so that you have that inspiration. Another great way to do this is a sketchbook. And sketchbooks seem sort of like a gimme, like everybody who's creative, everyone who has ideas, which you all do, should have one, but I'm sure that a lot of you don't. And you might be cheating yourself. I mean, how many ideas do you come up with on a daily basis? Hundreds, thousands, millions? How many of those do you actually remember? How many of those can you actually put to use? When you have something like a sketchbook, you can keep records, you can keep track of things, you can write down that guy you walked past was wearing the craziest hat you've ever seen, and that's going to inspire something later. You saw a car drive by you, and it makes you think of this way to make a nav on a website like you've never thought of before. these things are stuff that you forget. I forget all day, every day I forget stuff. But when you have a sketchbook, you provide yourself this test ground, this test bed to try out all of these ideas in a really, really loose form, and not worry about the rendering. You don't have to worry about the typography, the color, or anything like that. You're just representing an idea that's going to bring you back to that moment when you first had it, bring you back to that moment when you had that emotional attachment to that inspiration.
What I really love about sketchbooks is they're a spontaneous activity. You know, you're stricken by something and you want to record it, so you grab your sketchbook and you scribble something in there, you draw something in there, whatever. So it's a spontaneous thing and it's an unpredictable thing. But there are things that you can do, I think, that are more predictable and more organized and arranged. Exercises that can help to keep you, you know, ready for inspiration. So there's this idea of being a design vigilante that was come up with by a friend of ours, Kevin Cornell, who does Bearskin Rug. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar. And basically, it involves, you know, every day you're surrounded by horrific design. It's everywhere. It surrounds you. And if you're like me, it offends your sensibilities at every level. And you're disgusted all the time.
No one's like you.
Why not take it back? I mean, you love design, so take it back, right? This horrible supermarket circular that came in the mail that's just, you know, filled with these horrible typography and no white space and dreadful colors. Redesign it. Make it better. Make it tasteful. The missing dog sign that's been hanging on the telephone pole outside your house for the last 2 weeks that's, you know, typed up in Microsoft Word and Comic Sans and has this horribly pixelated dog photo that nobody could possibly recognize. You know, make it better. Make it so that the dog can actually be found and people will have incentive to find the dog. You know, what's to stop you from going out under cover of darkness and fixing the wrongs of other people? This is what being a design vigilante is all about. You love design, take it back. On a more subdued note, there are lots of activities and exercises that are a little less obviously related to design that I think are really beneficial. And puzzles are one of them. Puzzles are really, you know, they're problem-solving exercises. And the difference between, you know, problem-solving in puzzles and problem-solving in design is that in puzzles there's really only one solution. I'm a firm believer in the idea that if you become adept at solving problems in puzzles, it'll really give you a leg up on solving design problems and maybe give you a different perspective on them. So, for example, crossword puzzles, there's a lot of great opportunity there where, you know, it forces you to ponder the relationships between words and letters, and these relationships could be grammatical, thematic, visual, spatial, all these different relationships and ideas. And the way that these crossword puzzles are constructed really force you to kind of flex your brain and figure out how these things fit together. Last year, there was a documentary called Wordplay that came out. And for being a documentary about crossword puzzles, it was actually very successful. And the one thing that really kind of grabbed me in this documentary is they interviewed a lot of crossword constructors. And these are the people that actually make these things. And if you think about it for a second, I mean, would you be able to put together a crossword puzzle? It's a tremendous undertaking. These are people that are doing it on a daily basis. So one of the crossword constructors is being interviewed as he's driving around town. And he's sort of making these off-the-cuff observations, one of which was he notices the Dunkin' Donuts logo on the corner. He says, look, there's the Dunkin' Donuts logo. If you just take the D at the beginning of Dunkin' and move it to the end of Dunkin', you've got unkind donuts. And that completely floored me, right? I mean, it's such a simple observation, but how many people are really going to make that observation? And these are the kind of observations that designers need to be making. So I think there's a lot that can be learned from crossword puzzles and crossword constructors. They're designers in their own right, as I said, and it's I think there's a lot of value in that. Now, a lot of people create their own personal projects that they can work on off the clock or on the clock. And because, you know, client work can really be frustrating sometimes. So people will create their own personal projects, and often they'll give themselves complete freedom because it's a reaction to client work, which has these rigid restrictions, which, you know, like we said, can be very frustrating. But the problem is these limitations that are imposed upon your work, your professional work, are really what helps to give that work focus. And I think it's a mistake to give yourself as complete freedom in your personal projects because they can benefit from just as many limitations as your professional work, if not more. One example is something I started doing a couple of years ago called Daily Haiku. And it's pretty much just what you think it is. I write a haiku every day based on the dictionary.com word of the day. And so I've got the initial limitation of the haiku structure, which is three lines of 5, 7, and 5 syllables. And then on top of that, I've placed another restriction where I have to use the dictionary.com word of the day in context. So here's an opportunity to wrestle with the language to make it fit into this structure and learn a new word, right? And I think the stuff that I usually wind up coming up with is far more interesting and fun than anything I would have come up with if I just started with a blank slate. So, for example, after his kids were trampled by Digerati, he stopped reading Wired. They dread the onus of college graduation. Oh, they're art students. Trans Am headlights pierce the thick crepuscular mist, questing for tube tops. If I just sat down and said, I'm going to write a haiku about tube tops, I certainly wouldn't have used the word crepuscular. I might not have come up with the Trans Am thing. I mean, this isn't any brilliant poem, obviously, but I think it's a lot more interesting than anything I could have come up with a blank slate.
Rob and I are also very big film nerds, and every year, I would say, this project comes around, travels around from town to town in the city, or in the United States, called the 48-Hour Film Project. Basically, they come to your town, they let you organize a team of filmmakers, amateur and otherwise people who maybe shouldn't even be behind a camera. But they help organize this competition where you're supposed to make a film in mere 48 hours. And this is not a full film, but a short film, like 6-7 minutes. But it's a tremendous undertaking, 48 hours to get your concept, write a script, cast it, get costumes, get props, film it, edit it, and actually get it to the drop-off location in time. It leaves little time for sleep, lots of arguments, lots of fights, lots of beer and coffee.
More beer.
The other wrinkle to this is that they assign you criteria in order to make sure that people aren't going to cheat ahead of time or, you know, make their films before they actually get their assignment. You're assigned a genre, you're assigned a line of dialogue, a prop that you have to include, and a character that has to appear in the film. So, for instance, the first one that we got is called Dial a Spy. The genre was spy film. The character was Jessie Thomas, and she's a success coach. The line of dialogue was, can't you see I'm working here, and the prop was a bicycle. And the basic run of the plot is we have a character whose girlfriend leaves and he hires a spy to go check up on her, and eventually the spy ends up stalking the guy. And later we find out this is very similar to the plot of Cable Guy, but we didn't realize that at the time. So the next one that we got was... The genre is Western or musical. They give you the choice of Western musical because those genres are so awful to receive, to have to make a 48-hour film for, that you get to choose between a rock and a hard place. The character was...
M. Drake.
M. Drake, magician.
Yeah.
The line of dialogue was, get a move on, there's no time to lose. And the prop was a Rolodex. So our handsome protagonist finds out that Every day at high noon, he turns into a cowboy, and an hour later, he wakes up to realize that some cowboy-related events have transpired, and he has no memory of these.
If you're wondering why he's turning into a cowboy, it's obviously because he was bitten by a vampire cowgirl.
Yes, clearly.
Yeah.
So we didn't really have the resources to make a traditional Western. We didn't have, you know, dusty roads and ghost towns and six shooters and stuff. So we did it in office, and we took a different spin on it. The next one we did, once again, we drew Western or musical, and damned if we're going to actually be able to make a musical in a weekend with everything else that we had to do. This one's called Rustling Up Respect with Jay Upton, who's a dog walker, but we added that to his name, so now he's a cowboy, Jay Upton Dog Walker, and... A slightly less handsome protagonist
hey.
Leads us through
my feelings.
Leads us through a sexual harassment workplace educational film. And later we get sci-fi. And the thing about this is these are very much design problems, too. You're dealing with these criteria that you could see as limitations or you could see as opportunities. These criteria help you to gain focus for your project. The world is not your oyster here. You have 48 hours to get a specific task done, and you need focus in order to get that done. And by providing these criteria, which some people might see as a limitation because they might have some other crazy idea, or vision, but we have always seen them as opportunities to sort of narrow our focus and actually get something done on time.
So, I think if there's one fundamental companion to the concept of inspiration, it's the idea of a muse. And a muse is obviously someone or something that you can reliably look to inspire you. And it could be one of many, many things. A few years ago, Jason and I and another good friend of ours, Matt Sutter, lived in an apartment together, and we all had June birthdays. So we decided we were going to throw a joint birthday party for ourselves. And it couldn't just be any normal, boring party. It had to have a theme, and it had to be very complicated, and it had to be entirely too much work. So we put our heads together, and we decided that since we're all horror film fanatics, we would turn our home into Camp Naked Terror. So this is a summer camp slasher themed birthday party. And we have our guests come in costume, and they need to be either a camper, a killer, or a counselor. And we have prizes for the best and worst costumes. We have your typical party fare, music and dancing and food and booze. It's a whole lot of fun. So as everyone knows, there's most good horror films set themselves up for a sequel. And so we made a sequel. And we kept doing this every year. And what would happen is, at the end of each year, there would be a bloodbath, and Camp Naked Terror would close its doors forever. And then the next year, it would sort of miraculously reopen and be reinvented as a new kind of summer camp where the bloodbath could happen all over again.
Under new management.
Yeah. So it might reopen as a rock and roll camp. Or a movie camp. Or a video game camp. Or maybe it's a camp in the distant future. So maybe. What we would be doing here is each year we'd add a twist to the theme that we already had in place. And this challenged us then to find ways to combine these themes. So, and that might be with the branding, because of course we've got a brand identity for the whole party, which changes each year. And then of course that trickles down into the birthday cakes, which are themselves branded based on whatever kind of camp it is that year. And then, of course, there are the costumes. So the costumes is where it really gets interesting, because it's not just us now. It's everybody else that's coming to the party. And so we're not just challenging ourselves. We're challenging our guests and our friends to come up with these costumes that not only satisfy the summer camp slasher criteria, but also the new twist on the camp. So, okay, doing a summer camp slasher costume is really easy, but how do I cross it over with rock and roll? You know, how do I cross it over with video games? And what would happen is people would get really into this, and they would spend a lot of time on their costumes, even though we'd only announced the theme about a month in advance. And everybody would be trying to outdo each other and trying to outdo themselves from the year before. Are the Evil Dead credits? And the whole thing was basically just sort of, maybe this is a poor choice of words, but this like orgy of inspiration. All these ideas bouncing around and people just having a really good time with it. So this pretty quickly became a big part of our lives. It takes a lot of time and energy to put these things together. And it became a big part of our friends' lives too, because it's just a lot of fun to get together and dress up in crazy costumes and get blood all over the place. So we want to remember every minute detail of every party. So, of course, we've got to create memorabilia. So to go with the brand identity, we do we silkscreen a poster each year. We design silkscreen T-shirts.
As if there isn't enough to do.
Yeah. And of course, if you're going to be, you know, making posters and T-shirts and selling them to people, you've got to put together a website. And the website, you know, of course, also has to have pictures from the party. And some people get inspired and create their own things for the website. Our good friend Ian Corey decided that we needed to have a trailer.
In case you're wondering who the guy with the big red beard is, that's Rob's roommate Kevin, as
future
Rob from the future.
Future Rob.
That wasn't horrifying enough. Marriage. One of my biggest muses is my wife Liz, who I hope is still here if she hasn't ditched out to another panel. And she's a constant source of inspiration, and she knows how much design sort of pervades my life, and it injects itself into everything that I do. And when it came time to get married, she knew that she wanted to handle a lot of the organizational stuff, and I immediately said, ooh, I want to do the invitations. I want to do all of the promotional materials. She said, promotional materials? What the hell are you talking about? And I said, oh, we need a website, and we need a logo. And so we do all this stuff for our films. Why not do it for our wedding, too? So I decided, you know, I can take this love I have for design and this love I have for my wife, and I can combine the two and find a lot of inspiration there and turn that into some, you know, design. This is stuff that I do on a day-to-day basis, but I can really get into this because it has a deeper emotional meaning to me. So I can do our invitations, and I can do our table cards and the CDs that we give away, and, you know, everything has a logo and a look, and I've basically branded our wedding now. And the cool thing about this is guests would come up to us, you know, and they would say, I knew exactly where to sit because this thing looked like the invitation. And that's great. You know, my 60-year-old aunt can find her seat because she recognized that something looked like the invitation. That's design. That's design at work. Of course, we need a website, too, so we throw that together. And I basically just kept my head down and did all this stuff like it was another job on my roster. While Liz was planning a lot of the more important details, I guess. But the funny thing here is that I can spin these two lives I have together. I can spin this life that I have with my wife and this life that I have as a designer into something bigger. And I found so much inspiration in that very fact that it this stuff was a pleasure to work on.
So... Every year around the holidays, Jason and I and a bunch of our friends do a Secret Santa. And the one rule is that you have to make the gift. And if you have a hard time finding a muse in your life, this is actually kind of a good way to be assigned one. Because, you know, you're randomly assigned the person that you are the Secret Santa for. And one fateful year, I was Jason's Secret Santa. So... Jason and I have known each other for a very long time. We know each other really well. We're very close. And I know him so well that I know a lot of things that not a lot of other people know. And one of those things is that his real name is not Jason. His real name is Stan. And you can ask him later, and he'll tell you that that's not true. But you can take my word for it today, on record, that his name is Stan. So, Stan's a great guy. Everybody loves Stan. Look at him. How could you not?
Hi.
And, but really, not everybody knows him as well as I do. So I thought, wouldn't it be cool if there was a virtual version of Stan that could keep his friends company when he's not around and could let them know about some of his kind of lesser-known quirks? So, for example, there's his real voice, which he only uses around people he really trusts.
I'm Stan!
You should all feel very honored. He loves to identify himself. It's like his favorite thing to do. I mean, even when he's really pissed off, he loves it.
I'm Stan!
Stan loves music. Everybody loves music, but not everybody knows that Stan is himself a musician. He loves to sing, and he even wrote his own song, which in true Stan fashion, he uses to identify himself. And what
I'm Stan! I'm gonna sing my song now!
Now, Jason mentioned earlier, or Stan, I should say. I got so used to this Jason thing for this talk. He is a big sci-fi nerd, so I figured he really ought to have his own robot pal.
This is my friend Zorthron. I am a
young. And Stan's a world traveler, too. He's been all over the place, especially these last few years. And so his friends are going to want to share that, too. And they're going to want to go with him to some of his favorite places. They're going to want to hang out with him, you know, in Italy or Middle Earth or the Apple Store. Last but not least, Stan, you know, he has his own songs, but, you know, he likes the classics. He likes to belt out a crowd pleaser. And so he does. And he still manages to really kind of make it his own.
Thankfully, it ends there.
So that's Virtual Stan. It's been online for about 2 years now, and really kind of unexpectedly, it sort of exploded overnight, and it has now been visited by millions of people who have both loved it and hated it. But what's really kind of fascinating is the vast, vast majority of those people are not in on the joke at all. And I think that's a pretty amazing thing. And this came about from this fun community project wherein I was assigned a muse and I had a good friend to inspire me.
Aww. So we've talked about what inspiration is, where we find it, how to maintain it, and how to keep that environment sort of rich. And these are, I mean, not wholly universal rules, but these are things that inspire Rob and myself. And I feel like that... some of the methods that we're describing are universal, and they can be used for just about anyone. But the thing to remember here is that inspiration is all around you, and you have to leave yourself open to see it. You have to leave yourself open to experience the world around you so that you can pluck inspiration out of it when you need it, and you can catalog it, you can store it, whether it's in your mind or on your computer, you know, find different methods to get to the same, to get the different solutions for the same problems. And you're at South by Southwest. There is so much inspiration flying around here, in the hallways, out at the bar. You know, you have to be inspired by all of these great ideas, and you have to leave yourself open to it. That's it. Are there any questions?
Don't be shy. I think there's a microphone there.
We've inspired them. There's nothing left to do. Yes. The question is, when I keep that iPhoto library, how do I keep that separate from my family photos and stuff? And the simple answer is I don't take pictures of my family at all. But
he has lots of pictures of himself. It's really creepy.
Meticulously categorized. The simple answer is that I just use albums. I mean, it's easy enough to name things. Yeah, it's all in how you name them and how you... I definitely do not go over the top of the organization. I just keep them in separate albums and go from there.
Anybody else?
Over there.
Oh, Mason. I thought you said hi, Jason. Hi, Jason.
You talked mostly about personal work here. Do you think differently when you're dealing with client work and how you translate that?
The question was, we've talked mostly about personal work here. How do we treat client work and how do we find inspiration there? And I think one of the things we actually had to cut out was a client piece that Rob had worked on, so I think he should take this.
Honestly, I know we didn't draw a lot of really obvious direct lines between this stuff and professional work, but I think it trickles down in kind of invisible ways. It's really about just kind of being excited by everything that you see, and if you can do that, then you can be excited by the possibilities in the client work as well. That's probably a little bit more abstract of an answer than you were looking for, but that's really the best way I could answer it.
Another point here is we ran into Jim Caudill a little bit ago before this panel, and he had mentioned that nothing gets him inspired like a deadline, and that deadline will inspire him to do something that has nothing to do with the project that's due. And that's very much the way that inspiration works, because it's this sort of fluid experience, so you might be able to draw inspiration directly from a client or their logo or you know what's behind their organization, but that inspiration can also come from somewhere else. You know, you might get that inspiration from a film, and then that filters into your client work. Inspiration is not wholly resigned to just being, you know, I just got this assignment, now what am I going to do with it? The client has this name, what does that do for me? You know, inspiration doesn't work that way, and it has to come from all angles.
Back here? This young.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
We'll get
you next. Yeah, you go ahead.
Me?
Oh. Oh, hey, there's somebody at the microphone.
Oh, even better.
Wow.
Can I use it?
Yeah, you're at the microphone. You win.
That's better.
Yay, this is a good strategy. Thanks for your presentation. I thought it was fantastic.
Thank you.
A lot of the stuff that you're talking about, obviously, is about kind of personal inspiration. But a lot of us work in teams where people won't necessarily take this initiative themselves. I was wondering if you had any experience in kind of using some of these techniques to inspire teams that you work with.
Definitely.
Yeah. I don't think we need to repeat that. But the best thing about working in a team, I find, I think that I work even better in a team, as you can see, like the films and the parties and stuff that we do, is brainstorming. Oh, man, it's great to just bounce ideas around a room, you know, not even worry about what's good, what's bad, just seeing, you know, what falls out, because that's, you know, you say something silly and then someone else is making a joke and it spirals out into something completely different.
There's really something to be said for the value of community. And I don't, you know, we didn't say that explicitly in the presentation, but I think it comes across, especially in the film stuff and the party stuff. Your team at work, you know, even if not everybody has the initiative to kind of jump up and get all excited, there can be, I mean, there's obviously a leader for the team, and it's that leader's responsibility to get people excited, get people involved. And at HappyCog, we've got a really amazing group of people, and I think part of what makes it amazing is the rapport that we have with each other and the way that we bounce ideas off of each other. And so some of those things are organized, like every Friday we do a show and tell, where you just bring something in that you found interesting. It doesn't have to be related to anything. It doesn't have to be, you know, sometimes it is. Sometimes it's a code sample or a website or whatever. Sometimes it's, you know, a piece of gum that looked like the Virgin Mary, you know.
Oftentimes it's a Virgin Mary.
Yeah, well, that's usually my contribution.
But the thing about inspiration is that, the thing about inspiration is that, especially on a team, it's contagious. Even if there's someone who doesn't take that initiative themselves, they don't keep a sketchbook, they don't care, you know, what kind of signs they walk by on the way to work. When you start showing and describing and sharing your inspiration, it's infectious. And other people latch onto that, and they wonder, you know, why didn't I look at that sign that way? What's wrong with me? And there's something wrong with them.
this gentleman right here, and then you behind him. Yeah.
I was just saying, y'all talked a lot about inspiration, and a lot of these projects you were showing us had a very limited scope in their audience. And a lot of what I do, I like to have reward in what I do, and like that audience is my reward. How do you guys connect that reward to, like, it seems like you don't need a lot of reward to create this awesome, like, party or this awesome business card that not a lot of people are going to see. How do you connect that small reward to that finished product?
That's the reward itself, is the actual product. We were in a panel with Aaron Kassane and Greg Story earlier, and Greg had this great slide up with a quote that I've seen dozens of times, but it really resonated with me today, and it was, dance like no one's watching. it doesn't matter who sees this stuff. This is stuff that lets us feel creative. It lets us express ourselves. And whether that's 10 people or 10 million, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't.
Okay, I think I don't know how much time we have, but we have at least one more.
We have a couple minutes.
We can get you after on the
back there.
So I actually come from a graphic design background. I think it was really interesting to see sort of a nostalgia of the inspiration again today. But my question is, how much of the tools, the software or the technology has either come in your way or you've been able to embrace it in your phase of inspiration? Has it been a constraint, a fear, or not?
Well, I mean, technology and design really have an interesting relationship, right? It's a symbiotic kind of relationship. And the way that things look now, the way that, you know, the design trends that are happening now are things that were not could not have possibly been produced even 50 years ago, things like that. So there's certainly that relationship there. I guess we didn't talk about technology too much today.
No, but the thing that's interesting, especially how this applies to the interactive work that we do, is, I mean, the interactive medium as it is now is I believe, the only medium where you pretty much have to use a computer to do it. You have to make your website on a computer. That's just the way that it works. But when we had that sort of grounding in some of the more traditional print forms, and, you know, like we did the letterpress class, that it changes your way of thinking. You don't immediately say, all right, I have to make a website, so I'm going to open up Photoshop and start pushing stuff around. You start to think about, all right, what are the different ways that I could design this? What's the message that I'm trying to communicate? So, you know, you might get out your sketchpad and you realize, wow, I could really use silkscreen, like a silkscreen texture on this site. So then you do that and you scan it in. And I think you have to realize that the computer and these programs are all just tools, just like letterpress. It's a tool. It's just an option that you have. And you have, you know, innumerable ways to combine all of these options into something that can be amazing.
First off, I just wanted to say the design vigilantism idea, I'm totally down with that.
Good.
Every flyer in my neighborhood is now
go under preach.
Construction, yeah.
Where's your ski mask?
Yeah. I need to go get one. I've been thinking a lot lately about bad design. And strangely, the inspiration, not necessarily just to change it, but what things that we can take from it, like having to deal with MySpace every day and... things like that has made me really think a lot about how to reach more people and what makes sense to a larger audience. So could you speak a little bit to that?
Actually, yeah. You know who could speak a lot to that if you get a chance to meet him, because he's here. I don't know. He's probably not here, but he's at South By. Zay Frank talks a lot about that, and he has a lot of very interesting things to say about it. He's a lot of very interesting experience with it because he's created this whole community around his website. And he has really sort of embraced that whole bad design thing and reaching out and sort of taking design back to the people. So I think the way that he looks at it is it's not bad design. It's like design for everybody. You know what I mean? But how do you make that so that it doesn't hurt your eyes? That's a good question. And I would say if you can find Zay, and I think he's doing a presentation or hosting the Web Awards or something. Yeah. I'm sure he'll have something to say about
that. That's a presentation unto itself.
Yeah, so.
All right, let's do one more.
Anybody else? One more?
Yes, Malarkey. You.
How much do we have to pay you to finish Virtual Stand 2?
Oh, God.
The question is, how much do they have to pay Rob to finish Virtual Stand 2? How much do I have to pay you to not finish Virtual Stand 2?
I'm happy to do an auction right now between Stan and everybody else. Yeah, I would gladly accept boatloads of money for Virtual Stand 2. I haven't thought about a figure. I will consider it. But if anyone is curious, and it sounds like Malarkey is, there is a little something else in the works that will happen at some time before we're all dead. Hopefully. That's all I can say. I think we're out of time.
Thank you
everyone so much. Really appreciate it.